The audio letter cassette tape reports were recorded over a period from June 1975 to November 1982 by Dr. Peter Beter. Each audio letter tape report is approximately 1 hour in length. The basic schedule of release was once a month, but the exact date of release each month was flexible to accommodate events. There were also two periods during which the audio letter reports were suspended temporarily. The first, which extended from May to August 1977, separated audio letter issues number 24 and hash 25, and took place due to an action campaign by Dr. Beter with his listeners. The second suspension extended from February to June 1980, and separated issues number 54 and number 55. It was brought about by a major heart attack which Dr. Beter suffered while in the midst of recording audio letter number 54. Dr. Beter terminated his audio letter cassette tape report series in November 1982, after recording audio letter number 80. Having fought heart-related ailments for years, his health was declining. After conferring with doctors, he decided that the time had come to discontinue recording the tapes. The Dr. Beter audio letter series grew out of Dr. Beter's collaboration with supporters who first learned about Dr. Beter by way of radio talk shows in 1974. At that time, Dr. Beter was in great demand to appear on talk shows nationwide, which he did in most cases by long-distance telephone hookup from his residence in suburban Washington, D.C. After many years as a highly successful Washington attorney, government official and international legal and financial consultant, Dr. Beter had become famous in 1973 as the author of a best-selling book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar. In his talk shows, Dr. Beter had a habit of saying things which sounded preposterous at the time, but which were proven correct later on. Early in 1973, he declared that Vice President Spiro Agnew would be swept up in a sudden scandal beginning in late summer that would lead quickly to his resignation. At the time, Agnew was flying high, and it sounded like an unlikely turn of events. But it happened, right on schedule. In the spring of 1974, Dr. Beter described a sequence of events by which the Watergate scandal would make Richard Nixon the first U.S. president in history to resign. At the time, Watergate seemed to be running out of steam, and Nixon appeared to be toughing it out. Even less believably, Dr. Beter described a secret agreement which he said existed by which then-Vice President Gerald Ford would nominate Nelson Rockefeller to be his new vice president after Nixon resigned. In the spring of 1974, those things sounded hard to believe indeed. But they took place. Dr. Beter claimed that events like these, while shocking to the public, were planned far in advance. He said that they were known within certain intelligence and even business circles here in America and abroad. Drawing upon his extensive contacts with these circles, Dr. Beter was making public what the privileged few already knew. Having begun as skeptical listeners to Dr. Beter's radio appearances, a small group of private citizens became increasingly concerned as they saw Dr. Beter's revelations proven correct, time after time. They decided to investigate further, and finally contacted him. In September 1974, Audio Books, Inc., was founded by these supporters of Dr. Beter to provide an avenue by which Dr. Beter could make his reports public without censorship or cut off by those who controlled the radio waves. After several individual audiobook R tapes, the Dr. Beter audio letter series began in 1975. About Dr. Beter, note, born June 21, 1921, died March 14, 1987, JV, Dr. Peter Beter, yes. It rhymes, first came to widespread popular attention in 1973, through his best-selling nonfiction book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, George Braziller, Inc., NY. It was a gripping tale of international economic intrigue and monetary manipulation, carried out by the coordinated action of multinational corporations grown more powerful than many of their host countries. The objective, to deliberately undermine and ultimately destroy the United States dollar, as a major tool of political and economic conquest under the banner of a new imperialism. A crescendo of unhappy consequences were to be expected: an accelerating economic stagflation, a now popular word coined years ago by Dr. Beter, deteriorating financial status of municipal and state governments, deepening social unrest, increasing tensions over the Panama Canal, and more. Events during the past decade have followed to an astonishing degree the blueprint which Dr. Beter revealed in his book. In September 1974, Dr. Beter acquired a new distinction as the man who opened Fort Knox. The previous April, Dr. Beter had charged in congressional testimony that the legendary U.S. bullion depository at Fort Knox had been looted of America's monetary gold hoard allegedly stored there. He stood ready to present evidence and witnesses to substantiate his charges. But neither a grand jury nor a congressional inquiry into the matter materialized, so Dr. Beter then took his case directly to the public. Through lectures, radio talk shows, and publication of his charges in a tabloid newspaper, National Tattler, he was able to put such intense pressure on the federal government that a completely unprecedented step was taken in order to still the public outcry. The U.S. Treasury Department arranged a so-called gold inspection visit for a few congressmen and 100 invited newsmen on September 23, 1974. Significantly, however, Dr. Beter himself was not among those invited, nor was any other outside expert on gold. The celebrated Fort Knox visit and the so-called gold audit, which followed, contained many irregularities which the Treasury Department has never explained. In audio letter tapes number 14 and number 15, July and August 1976, Dr. Beter made public intelligence he had been given that the Soviet Union was planting short-range underwater missiles in U.S. territorial waters in preparation for a surprise nuclear attack. In issue number 15, he listed navigational coordinates for 64 missiles which he said had been planted worldwide so far, urged his listeners to pressure the Joint Chiefs of Staff to take counteractive measures, and in effect dared the government to prove him wrong. The resulting hue and cry from Dr. Beter's listeners nationwide created shock waves within the U.S. government which were never reported by the major news media. In mid-September 1976, Dr. Beter and an associate met for over an hour with General George S. Brown, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, in General Brown's Pentagon office. Only 2 weeks earlier, a letter over General Brown's signature had been sent to Dr. Beter, with photocopies to concerned citizens nationwide, seeming to say that Dr. Beter's charges about Soviet underwater missiles had been investigated and found untrue. Yet when Dr. Beter then requested a meeting with General Brown to relay to him the locations of a second round of 48 newly planted missiles, the meeting was granted without delay. The Pentagon confirmed to the press that the meeting had taken place, but never explained this curious sequence of events. See, e.g., Norfolk, VA. Ledger Star, September 27, 1976, p. 8, article by G. Bradshaw and J. Kestner. Or see Chicago Tribune, December 4, 1977, Section 2, Special Report, Undersea Warfare. Professional credentials. The things made public by Dr. Beter are extraordinary, but so is the professional background which preceded his public visibility. He practiced general law in Washington, D.C., from 1951 to 1961, becoming a member of the U.S. Court of Military Appeals in 1952 and the U.S. Supreme Court in 1964. Many of his cases were against the federal government, all of which he won, including one case in which he caught none other than the U.S. Department of Justice burning records in an attempt to defeat him. The resulting decision, Farley v. U.S., 131 CCLs, 776 1955, 127 F. Sup. 562, made new law. In 1961, President John F. Kennedy appointed Dr. Beter counsel to the U.S. Export-Import Bank, the largest government-owned bank in the Western world, where he served until 1967. After leaving the XIM Bank, Dr. Beter became an international financial and legal consultant, as well as one of the chief developers of private international business in the Republic of Zaire. He is a member of the Judicature Society, the Bankers Club of America, the Royal Commonwealth Society of London, and the United States Naval Institute. He is listed in biographical reference works such as Who's Who in the East, The Blue Book of London, and 2000 Men of Achievement, London. A bird's eye view of the Dr. Beter audio letter R, excerpted from the Dr. Beter audio letter R, reference digest copyright, C, Audiobooks Inc., 1983. Some general remarks. The 80 cassette tapes which make up the Dr. Beter audio letter series contain an enormous amount of information. It would take the equivalent of 2 40-hour work weeks just to listen to the entire 80 tape set once through. In those 2 weeks, the listener would see over 7 years of major current events come to life in a unique way. He would see the unseen forces at work which make sense out of what otherwise seemed to be chaotic, irrational news events. And he would learn many eye-opening historical background lessons which are little known, yet which are vital to understanding how we got where we are today. Unfortunately, though, it would be like taking a drink from a fire hose. The listener would absorb a lot in a hurry, but also, a lot more would get by him. At the opposite extreme, those who subscribed to the Dr. Beter audio letter tapes had the advantage of absorbing each tape, one at a time, in context with then-current news events. But the tapes were released over a period of over 7 years, from June 1975 through November 1982. It would be a rare intellect that could keep all the salient details of all the tapes in mind, meshing them together with each new tape, over all that time. Dr. Beter tried to alleviate this problem by summarizing past developments from time to time, but the basic problem remains. And when it comes to a review, even the longtime listener is faced with somewhat the same drink from a fire hose problem posed by the 80-tape collection. For both the longtime subscriber and the newly acquainted listener, a roadmap is needed. That is the purpose of the audio letter reference digest. In this bird's eye view section, we will try to boil down the broad insights of the 80-tape audio letter report series as concisely as possible. We will keep details to a minimum, aside from examples to illustrate particular points. Given the broad outlines of this section, we believe that all the details in Section 2 and Section 3, not to mention in the tapes themselves, will be easier to grasp and far more meaningful than they would be if viewed in isolation. In the long term, it is this broader picture of the basic forces behind current events which is the most important of all to understand. Even though some of the developments discussed in the tapes have run their course, the forces which brought them about continue to operate today. Comprehending how those forces led to yesterday's events is the key to seeing through countless new events today and tomorrow. Politics. The three rival factions for world power. Decades ago, Franklin D. Roosevelt said, "Nothing in politics ever happens by accident. If it happens, you can bet it was planned that way." Decades earlier, Benjamin Disraeli, famed as the Victorian-era Prime Minister of Britain, wrote, "The world is governed by people far different from those imagined by the public." Taken together, these two statements illustrate the basic premise which underlies all of the Dr. Beter audio letter tape reports. This premise is that major events in politics, economics, and international relations are the products of deliberate moves by largely unseen power factions in the world. All of these factions seek to increase their influence over us, the general population of the world. Each one also wishes to increase its own power at the expense of the other power factions. Thus, there is an ongoing power struggle of titanic dimensions which constantly shapes the news, yet which is little understood, indeed unsuspected, by most people. If these forces are not recognized or understood, current events are inherently baffling, no matter how diligently one may follow the news. This leaves even the best educated and most intelligent of persons vulnerable to manipulation to suit the purposes of those who pull the strings behind the scenes. By contrast, if the largely unseen forces are known and understood, major events become far more understandable and even, to some extent, predictable. Those informed about these things become far less vulnerable and more difficult to fool by manipulated news and news events. To choose just one of the many dramatic examples from the audio letter series, consider the Guyana massacre at Jonestown in November 1978. From start to finish, the Guyana story was filled with anomalies, unanswered questions, conflicting government statements, and news reports that did not quite add up. It began with the slaughter of a U.S. congressman and accompanying newsman, yet there was never a subsequent congressional investigation. The victims died of cyanide poisoning, an excruciating death which leaves the face contorted in agony, yet the victims were found arranged in neat, peaceful-looking rows, face down. A few days after the massive infusion of American military teams supposedly for cleanup operations, there were sudden huge jumps in body bag counts. Hurried explanations by Pentagon spokesmen were so incredible that they were withdrawn and replaced by different stories. These and many more oddities about the Guyana episode were never resolved, but simply left to fade away from the public memory with time. For those unaware of the behind-the-scenes forces at work in the world, Guyana will remain forever unexplained, as if events so bizarre, major and chilling can happen for no reason at all. The key missing ingredient in all the news reports about Guyana was the existence of a secret Soviet intermediate-range missile base, not far from Jonestown. Dr. Beter had reported publicly about the base on many occasions for over 4 years prior to the sudden headlines from Guyana. He had also reported on the collapse of a cooperative arrangement formerly in effect between the true rulers of the United States and those of the Soviet Union. These were the factors which led directly to the Jonestown tragedy, a mass murder, staged as a cover to enable covert military action against the Russian missile base. Within days after the Jonestown tragedies, Dr. Beter audio letter number 40 made public exactly what had taken place and why. In that tape, Dr. Beter answered in detail questions which otherwise remain unanswered to this day. Over the course of the 80 audio letter tape reports, Dr. Beter reveals that three primary power factions are at work in the world today: 1. The Rockefeller Cartel, 2. The Bolshevik Zionist Axis, 3. The new Kremlin rulers. These factions as such have existed for the past century or so, and their relationships with one another have been in a constant state of flux. Their roots, however, are much older and can be traced backward in time for many centuries. The Rockefeller Cartel. The Rockefeller Cartel is the first of the three great power factions to be dealt with extensively in the Dr. Beter audio letter reports, for at least two reasons. First, while its scope is worldwide, it is headquartered in the United States. Second, it was indisputably the most powerful of the three factions when Dr. Beter began recording his audio letter reports in 1975. This situation changed dramatically later on. The Rockefeller Cartel today embraces several hundred of the world's largest multinational corporations: big oil, big banking, and big business. It is a new kind of empire, with economic assets so great as to be beyond effective control by mere governments. Its headquarters are American, but its perspective is global, with allegiance neither to the United States nor to any other country. It is an empire unto itself. What is today the Rockefeller Cartel was started over a century ago by John D. Rockefeller Sr. by his well-known cutthroat business tactics. Rockefeller created the Standard Oil Trust and made himself America's first billionaire by the turn of the century. Such blatantly unethical practices led to public opposition, which culminated in the Supreme Court decree of 1911 dissolving the Standard Oil Trust. By then, however, Rockefeller was becoming more sophisticated, finding ways to hide the true extent of his wealth and power while continuing to expand it. The trust-busting era had little lasting effect. By the use of nominees and other devices, it was possible to retain effective control and coordination of the superficially dismantled Standard Oil empire. Throughout the 20th century, from World War I onward, Rockefeller economic power has translated increasingly into Rockefeller political power. This, in turn, has been used to increase Rockefeller economic power still further. For example, oil has played a key role in all of America's major wars of this century, with the Rockefeller oil interests profiting handsomely. Yet this role has been generally obscured both in current news accounts during each war and in historical accounts written later on. The obscuring of key information of this type is a symptom of Rockefeller power expansion into the realms of journalism and teaching. Power is always most secure when it is not recognized, so every effort is made to keep information about it from becoming public. In a related vein, Rockefeller style public relations has been developed and refined since the turn of the century for similarly deceptive purposes. It began when John D. Rockefeller Sr., famous primarily for his greed, started changing his image by handing out dimes to people he chanced to meet on the street. At the same time, he also began making donations to charitable causes, always with great fanfare and publicity, to curry public favor as an alleged philanthropist. This led to the creation of tax-exempt foundations. These enabled Rockefeller money to be invested in organizations which looked philanthropic, yet which were actually avenues for further expanding Rockefeller power. The Rockefeller-controlled major foundations have been used to transform American life and values in directions which make America more susceptible to Rockefeller control. At the same time, the foundations serve an invaluable purpose as a disguised means for interlocking the various business interests which constitute the Rockefeller Cartel. John D. Rockefeller Sr. founded a true dynasty, passing on his plans and programs to be carried on by succeeding generations. John D. Rockefeller Jr. carried forward the Rockefeller program of ever-expanding power with particular emphasis upon subverting the Christian faith, which, historically, is the foundation of basic American ideals. But it was the Rockefeller, third generation, who expanded and developed the Rockefeller cartel to its zenith of power. Of the six members of the third generation, Sister Abby and Brother Winthrop did not much care for the grand plan, although Winthrop did become governor of Arkansas. But the other four brothers, John D. III, Nelson, Lawrence and David, threw themselves with crafty zest into the project of expanding the Rockefeller Empire. They carved up the world into spheres of influence, each concentrating upon his own areas but coordinating his actions with the others. They worked together as a unit, and throughout his audio letter tapes Dr. Beter often refers to them simply as the four Rockefeller brothers. From about World War II onward, it was the four Rockefeller brothers who held the reins of what had become the worldwide Rockefeller Empire. It was they who created the modern multinational corporation, and used American taxpayer money under the guise of foreign aid, after World War II to build up their corporate empire worldwide. World War II had been fought over Saudi Arabian oil, and it gave them an unprecedented financial windfall. The Rockefeller oil companies obtained Saudi oil at a net cost, after chargebacks and various devices, of about 5 cents per barrel for nearly 30 years, until the Arab oil embargo of 1973 finally put a halt to it. The awesome profits generated by Saudi Arabian oil enabled the Rockefeller brothers to buy up much of the industrial base of the United States, Europe and Japan. At the same time, Rockefeller power throughout Latin America, which had been established by Nelson Rockefeller during World War II, was expanded and deepened during the post-war years. John D. Rockefeller, III, masterminded the Rockefeller cartel economic takeover of much of Black Africa. Revolutions created Black governments which, lacking expertise, had to turn to Rockefeller multinational corporations to manage their resources. Lawrence Rockefeller busied himself with control of America's aerospace and defense industry, major airlines, and massaging the stock market. David, the youngest but most powerful, became the kingpin of the Rockefeller banking empire whose tentacles reach into business circles the world over. He also specialized in intelligence matters, although Nelson also was involved in this area. For decades, the four Rockefeller brothers had things pretty much their own way. They made plans, set up timetables, and generally carried them out without a hitch. But by the time Dr. Beter launched his audio letter tape report series, the Rockefeller brothers were beginning to show signs of slippage in their power. They had made mistakes, and some of their timetables were starting to slide. During 1974-75, they were tripped up in certain plans by partial public exposure of massive irregularities surrounding America's monetary gold supply. Next, during 1976-77, their long-standing secret alliance with the Kremlin fell apart, as their former allies, the Bolsheviks, were overthrown by a new ruling group in Russia. The four Rockefeller brothers made the mistake of welcoming expelled Bolsheviks from Russia into positions of power here in the United States. This led by early 1979 to the overthrow of the four Rockefeller brothers by the Bolsheviks here. First, John D. Rockefeller, III, died in an alleged auto accident in July 1978. Then in late January 1979, Nelson Rockefeller was murdered in the beginning of a full-fledged Bolshevik coup d'etat behind the scenes. Today the Rockefeller cartel is no longer under the direct control of the Rockefeller family as it was under the four Rockefeller brothers, but it remains a formidable force. As Dr. Beter ended his audio letter report series in November 1982, the regrouped Rockefeller cartel was gradually regaining some of its lost power in a bitter struggle against the Bolsheviks here. The Bolshevik Zionist Axis in 1917, during the height of World War I, two events took place which were destined to shape much of the history of the 20th century. One was the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. The other was the Balfour Declaration, by which the government of Britain threw its support behind the concept of creating a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Both Bolshevism and the political force known as Zionism have common roots which are not widely known. Both were created by the Rothschild interests, whose support was also responsible for the meteoric rise to riches of John D. Rockefeller Sr., a century ago. Bolshevism and Zionism also have common historical roots in the so-called Kingdom of the Jews of 1,000 years ago. This kingdom was situated in what is now southern Russia, between the Black and Caspian Seas. It consisted of a people known as the Khazars of a Mongol Turkic origin whose leader officially adopted Judaism as the state religion. This was done as a political ploy to enable Khazaria to maintain its political independence of two powerful neighbors. These were the superpowers of that day, the Muslim Empire of the Caliphs to the south and the Christian Empire of Byzantium to the west. Prior to the official adoption of Judaism, the Khazars were a brutal and warlike people. This did not change when they took upon themselves the politically inspired title of Jews. The Khazar Empire extended far northward into what, under Christian Prince Vladimir, became known as Russia. The Khazar Empire even included the ancient Russian city of Kiev, where Vladimir ruled. Khazar rule was brutal and oppressive, without any of the compensating advantages offered by other empires, such as protection against outside powers or improved civilization. Finally, the Christian forces of Prince Vladimir's Russia and Byzantium combined to attack the Khazar Kingdom of the Jews, so-called, and utterly destroy it. The Khazar Jews were driven out of their homeland between the seas, many of them into Eastern Europe. There they mingled to some extent with Jews of the diaspora from Palestine, but they carried with them a peculiar heritage. It was a heritage of bitter hatred for Christianity in general and for Russian Christians in particular. Down through the centuries, the Khazar Jew dream of regaining their lost empire has been passed down from generation to generation. This dream has developed into two branches. One branch emphasizes restoration of power over Russia, and crystallized into Bolshevism. The other branch, emphasizing the old, falsely religious, Kingdom of the Jews concept, emerged as the political force known as Zionism. Both are aimed at world power. Both are equally ruthless, devoid of regard for human life. They differ only in geographic emphasis and in some tactics. With their common roots and common basic objectives, the Bolsheviks and Zionists work together hand in glove. When Bolshevism was injected into Christian Russia in 1917, it was done with the help of the Rockefeller cartel. From that time onward, there was a covert alliance between those who controlled American policies behind the scenes, the Rockefeller cartel, and those who ran the Soviet Union, the Bolsheviks. The Rockefeller Standard Oil interests were given control over marketing of the oil from the giant Russian Baku oil fields in 1926. Over the years, the Rockefeller cartel saw to it that the Bolshevik regime in Russia was propped up in every way necessary to keep it in power. While the United States and the Soviet Union pretended to be at odds, they actually were involved in a pincers movement to gobble up the entire world. The falsified animosity between Washington and Moscow was staged in order to polarize the world and cause nations to form up into two camps dominated by the two superpowers. Those who chose to remain independent of both the United States and the Soviet Union, the so-called Third World, were targeted for brushfire wars and revolutions to bring them to heel, one by one. Meanwhile, the long-term goal was, in the words of a secret White House directive, to so alter life in the United States that it can be comfortably merged with life in the Soviet Union. In this way, an all-powerful, one-world government would ultimately be achieved. That was to be the fulfillment of a commitment established early in the 20th century by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Allied Foundations in the Rockefeller orbit. In order to merge American life into the pattern of Soviet life under the Bolsheviks, it was clear that the quality of American life would have to be lowered a great deal. It required subtle movement of the American political system in the direction of dictatorship. It required weakening of America's financial and monetary system. And to bring about the radical changes desired, it meant wars with the United States carefully maneuvered into a losing position. America's first no-win war was the Korean War. A decade later, America became embroiled in the losing Vietnam War, which was artificially dragged out with all possibilities for military victory vetoed by the White House. The final war was to be a carefully programmed, nuclear war one, fought primarily on American soil, between the United States and the Soviet Union. Plans called for it to erupt in the late 1970s, but developments in Russia changed that. The Bolsheviks, who had run the Kremlin since 1917, were the targets of a decades-long overthrow campaign by a tough sect of native Russian Christians. Their power had begun to outweigh that of the Bolsheviks in certain areas starting in 1953, when Stalin died. This was the reason for Nikita Khrushchev's famous de-Stalinization campaign afterward. In the mid-1970s, this anti-Bolshevik sect finally reached such a level of power that they completely overthrew and expelled the remaining Bolsheviks in the Kremlin. There followed a heavy wave of expulsions of Bolsheviks from positions of power in Russia, which was depicted in the Western press as emigration. As the Bolsheviks were losing their grip on Russia, so-called détente fell on hard times. The Rockefeller Soviet alliance had been based on Bolshevik control on the Soviet side, and when that was terminated, so was the secret alliance. The alliance was fractured by the still-secret underwater missile crisis of 1976. A year later, it was broken completely by the equally secret battle of the Harvest Moon in space. At that point, the four Rockefeller brothers made a fatal mistake. Since their former secret allies in the Soviet Union had been the Bolsheviks, they welcomed the expelled Bolsheviks from Russia into positions of power here in the United States. They reasoned that the expelled Bolsheviks would know the weak spots of the upstart new group who had taken over the Kremlin and could help the Rockefeller cartel deal with them. What the Rockefeller brothers forgot is that the Bolsheviks are incapable of sharing power with anyone. Worse yet, the Bolsheviks are state socialists, who seek to concentrate all power into the hands of a few, themselves, by way of government. The Rockefeller cartel, by contrast, represents corporate socialism, the concentration of power into the hands of a few by way of corporations, with minimum governmental interference. Both seek the same goal, but by means which are diametrically opposed. They cannot coexist within the same society. The Bolsheviks no sooner acquired positions of power here in the United States than they began using it to topple the four Rockefeller brothers. By mid-1978, Bolshevik influence within the Pentagon was causing a radical shift of American strategic policy onto a first-strike nuclear posture. Meanwhile, in July 1978, the death of John D. Rockefeller, III, took place, weakening what had been the four-brother unit. In November 1978, the Guyana massacre took place, as part of a military operation masterminded by the Pentagon Bolsheviks and with crucial participation by Israeli commandos. Then in January 1979, the all-out Bolshevik grab for power began with the murder of Nelson Rockefeller. During the first few months of 1979, Rockefeller power over the United States government was shattered by the Bolsheviks here. However, the Bolsheviks were stopped short of complete success in their takeover bid by the intervention of Russia's KGB. The new Kremlin rulers knew that a complete takeover by the Bolsheviks here would lead quickly to nuclear war, and they acted to prevent it. Even so, Bolshevik control over the Pentagon has been strong ever since early 1979, onward through the end of the audio letter series in late 1982. A fierce power struggle is underway within the United States government between the now entrenched Bolsheviks and the Rockefeller cartel, which is trying to take back its former power. In addition, a limited new quid pro quo against the Bolsheviks was established by the Rockefeller cartel and the new Kremlin early in 1982. The cartel and the Kremlin still have some accounts to settle with each other, but both are deadly enemies of the Bolsheviks. To destroy them, they have agreed to work together in certain ways. The Bolsheviks here in the United States have as a major goal a deliberate nuclear war by which to smash the Russia which overthrew them. As an avenue toward that war, the Middle East is critical. In that area, the Bolsheviks here are relying upon their close allies, the Zionists, to pave the way for war. Just as most Americans are unaware of the Bolshevized nature of their government, most Israeli citizens are unaware of the true goals of their Zionist government. Americans and Israelis alike scratch their heads with worry and puzzlement over actions of their respective governments. While constantly talking peace, both are systematically increasing the dangers of war. The radical Zionist regime in power in Israel from 1977 onward is headed by men who were terrorists in the 1940s. Today, as heads of the world's third most powerful military power, they continue to practice terrorism but on a grander scale. Theirs is a doctrine of military terrorism, designed to lead deliberately to new and wider conflicts as the map of Israel grows steadily. The country which calls itself Israel, today bears little resemblance to the promises of the small but vocal Zionist minority who brought about the Balfour Declaration in 1917. The peaceful, tranquil haven for oppressed Jews does not exist. Instead, the dire warnings published in 1919 by a galaxy of prominent anti-Zionist American Jews have been fulfilled in the bloody history of Zionist Israel. The new Kremlin ruler's Dr. Bieder first revealed in late 1977 that a new, non-Bolshevik ruling group had taken the reins of top power in the Soviet Union. In the autumn of 1978, he devoted a complete audio letter tape, #38, to a special report on Russia and her new rulers. To those who depend upon pronouncements of the United States government for their image of Russia, Dr. Bieder's reports about the new Kremlin tend to come as a distinct shock. Unlike the atheistic, satanic Bolsheviks recently overthrown, Russia's new top rulers are members of a sect of native Russian Christians. This sect is at least 2 centuries old, and at times had considerable influence with the Tsars. Dr. Bieder cautions his listeners not to assume that the new Kremlin rulers look at everything in the same way as Western Christians might. For one thing, he points out that it required a patient, arduous campaign of 6 decades for them to oust the Bolsheviks from top power in Russia. That experience has left them with very definite, vivid opinions about what does and does not work when dealing with people like the Bolsheviks and Zionists. They also know that rapid, radical change of any type opens the door for revolution, and where there is revolution, Bolshevik Zionist agents will be there to exploit it. They are introducing liberalizing changes in Russia gradually, one step at a time. Having come this far, they are trying not to move too fast and thereby risk allowing it all to be undone. Even so, visible changes are occurring. Early in 1979, the first legal shipment of Bibles into Russia since the Bolshevik Revolution took place. That Easter, Handel's Messiah was performed in Russia for the first time since the Bolshevik Revolution, and not in some out-of-the-way place, but at the Moscow Conservatory. Churches are reopening, one by one, all over the Soviet Union, and they are packed, as Dr. Billy Graham told the world upon returning from a Moscow religious conference in May 1982. For saying what he did about what he had seen of religion in Russia, Dr. Graham ran into a hostile reception here in the United States. The satanic Bolsheviks who now dominate the United States government are doing everything in their power to paint Russia as an enemy worthy of hate. Anything which interferes with that image is suppressed. Because someday, the Bolsheviks here want America to go to war against Russia. Economics. The man-made causes of worldwide economic disaster centuries ago, Mayor Amschel Rothschild, founder of the Rothschild dynasty, said, "Give me the power to issue a nation's money, and I care not who writes the laws. Money is a necessary ingredient in the advancement of civilization itself. As a store of value and a medium of exchange, money is vastly more convenient and flexible than any system of barter, which is the only alternative. Money facilitates division of labor, specialization by individuals according to their talents, and organization of human activity into complex patterns necessary for advancement in virtually all realms of endeavor. It even helps to make possible economies of scale and other efficiencies which raise human productivity far beyond the levels required for mere survival. This makes it possible for a society to support artistic and other cultural advancements by which a civilization becomes more refined and rich. In short, money is the economic glue which holds a society together. If it is honest, stable and unmanipulated, money plays a neutral role which is equally beneficial to all members of society. By working hard, for example, a person may earn more than is needed immediately to pay for whatever he buys from others. The excess can be saved, then spent whenever desired to meet an extraordinary expense, buy something special, or retire from work and live off the fruits of past labor. Money earned reflects work which is valued by society and for which one is paid. It is this role of money as the economic common denominator of society that makes it such a tool of immense power, satanic power, in the wrong hands. He who issues a nation's money can create out of thin air what all the rest of us have to earn by honest labor. The issuer of money thus acquires unparalleled power over other individuals, since at the stroke of a pen he can make others wealthy who cooperate in advancing his fraudulent schemes. In any society there are always more than enough individuals available who are eager to be comfortably corrupted in this way, and it is they who are helped into positions of governmental power. That is what Rothschild meant when he said, "I care not who writes the laws. The power to issue money is the power to shape government to one's own ends. If one has the power to issue a nation's money, then he also has the power to change its value. This changes the yardstick by which every single economic transaction in a society is measured, and is a way to steal from an entire society at once. He who sets aside the excess fruits of his labor in the form of money is robbed if, when he is ready to use it later, it is no longer worth the same amount. That is happening today in the United States. Of course, it is called inflation. By the time of the American Revolution, Rothschild financial power in Europe, and especially in Britain, was great. The stamp tax and other oppressive measures which helped trigger the revolution bore the signature of King George, but they originated in the House of Rothschild. The revolution broke the former colonies free of Rothschild money control. The framers of the United States Constitution well understood the evils of corrupt, privately issued money. Therefore, they refused to countenance the creation of any type of privately owned central bank. Instead, they gave the United States Congress the constitutional duty to issue and regulate the nation's money. The theory was that since Congress represents all the people, congressional control of our money should be the fairest and most equitable system possible. From then until the early 20th century, there were repeated attempts by the Rothschild interests to re-establish their lost money power here, either directly or indirectly. One example was the Bank of the United States, whose charter was canceled by President Andrew Jackson in 1832. Likewise, the Civil War involved not just questions of slavery and states' rights, but also a strong component of struggle over the issuance of money. But once again the attempt failed, thanks partly to intervention by the Russian Navy at a critical tide in the war to prevent Britain and France from dismembering the war-torn United States. For doing that, Russia was slated for destruction by the Rothschild interests. It was also decided that the best way to regain control over America's money was from within. To that end, the Rothschilds lent support to several promising groups within the United States, spawning the era of the robber barons. Out of that group, the Rockefellers soon rose to the top. In 1913, the Rothschilds finally saw the creation of what they had sought here in the United States, a privately owned central banking system, called the Federal Reserve System. It was a joint venture involving very heavy participation, in fact a lead role, by the increasingly powerful Rockefeller interests. But at least the Rothschilds at last had their foot back in the door for control of America's currency. In 1917, the Rothschilds accomplished their other goal, the destruction of Christian Russia, by way of the Bolshevik Revolution. As in the case of the Federal Reserve System, the basic concept was Rothschild-inspired, but it was Rockefeller muscle that made the plan a success. Having started out as Rothschild protégés, the Rockefeller cartel had risen already to the status of partners. And during the decades that followed, especially after World War II, the Rockefellers pulled ahead and eclipsed Rothschild power on the world stage. That situation continued until the end of the 1970s. Now, with the collapse of the family Rockefeller dynasty, the balance between the Rockefeller and Rothschild factions is in a state of flux, with both struggling for renewed supremacy. The Federal Reserve System was sold to the public as a prescription for improved economic stability. But the record shows that the stock market crash of 1929 and the ensuing Great Depression were brought about in large part by deliberate Federal Reserve actions. The great bull market of the 1920s was set in motion and sustained for most of a decade by means of easy credit. By 1929, the towering stock market was resting upon a huge, wobbly foundation of credit, that is, debt. The Federal Reserve Board then destroyed that foundation over a matter of mere months by severely contracting credit. The excuse given was designed to sound good, namely a crackdown on harmful speculation. But the real and predictable effect was to cause masses of investors to be suddenly unable to cover their margin stock market purchases, forcing them to sell stock to raise cash. The sell-off thus triggered fed upon itself, while the Federal Reserve Board did nothing to halt the plunge. The stock market crashed. Having set economic disaster in motion, the Federal Reserve Board soon thereafter made sure that it would mushroom into an all-out depression. This was brought about, not by the stock market crash itself, but but by the failure of the American banking system afterward. A key purpose of the Federal Reserve System is supposed to be the preservation of banking stability, by stepping in as the lender of last resort, among other things, to prevent a localized banking problem from spreading. But in the early 1930s, a then-major bank, the United States Bank of New York, collapsed while the Federal Reserve System steadfastly refused to lift a finger to stop it. This created a chain reaction which pulled down additional banks, which dragged down still others, and so on. The Federal Reserve System, far from stopping this process, had set it in motion and did not intervene as it progressed. This plunged America and then the entire world into the Great Depression of the 1930s. To most people, a depression is an unmitigated disaster. It is hard to imagine that anyone could benefit from it, much less bring it about deliberately. But for the money controllers and their wealthy allies, the Great Depression provided enormous opportunities for increased wealth and power. Knowing what was coming, they were able to avoid the crushing financial losses which befell everyone else. Then, during the depths of the Depression, they were in a position to buy up companies, real estate and other assets at a penny on the dollar. When the economy revived later on, these assets regained their value, producing vast profits for their new owners. Ironically, by using their money control to plunge the American economy into disaster, the money changers set the stage for still greater expansion of their authority over America's monetary system. When President Franklin D. Roosevelt took office in 1933, he launched a series of sweeping moves that began with the declaration of a bank holiday. The United States was taken off the gold standard. Americans were required to turn in all of their gold coins. Title to America's gold was then handed over, as a gift, to the Federal Reserve System. However, the Federal Reserve System was relieved of any need to spend time and money to take care of the gold which it now owned, as the U.S. Treasury Department was made physical custodian of the gold. The Federal Reserve System became freer than ever to tinker with America's economy by printing paper and controlling credit. The freedom grew steadily over the years as gold backing for the dollar was decreased. In 1968, President Johnson signed into law an act removing the final 25% gold backing requirement from the dollar. In 1971, President Nixon closed the international gold window, discontinuing settlement of international debts in gold. This left the United States dollar purely a piece of paper, totally divorced from gold or anything else of intrinsic value. This is an ideal situation for the money controllers, made to order for manipulation to enrich themselves at everyone else's expense. Since the dollar has been a worldwide reserve currency since 1944, this means that everyone on Earth is victimized by the dollar manipulation now underway in the US from 1971 onward. Inflation has been an ever-increasing problem in the United States and therefore worldwide. Each time it is damped down temporarily, it is slowed at the expense of rising unemployment and slumping economic activity. When the economy revives, inflation soon takes off again to new and higher levels. The Federal Reserve Board, claiming, as in 1929, to be looking out for our best interests, responds with crushing new interest rates that reach new historical highs. Again, unemployment shoots up, without ever having quite recovered from the previous cycle. Cycle after cycle, inflation and economic stagnation both keep getting worse. The balance between the two conditions keeps shifting back and forth, but both inflation and stagnation are with us continually and simultaneously. We are caught in the stagflation era foreseen by Dr. Beter in his 1973 book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar. The crumbling of the once powerful United States economy is a direct consequence, and an intended one, of the destruction of the dollar itself which is underway. The time will come when the dollar will collapse altogether, and with it the economy of the United States and much of the world as we know it. At that point, the same thing will have to be done that has always been done when other currencies have collapsed. There will have to be a new currency, a new dollar, with something behind it to restore confidence. The one commodity which has been a reliable, universally accepted basis for monetary confidence for thousands of years is gold. And so, gold will have to be used in setting up a new system of stable international currencies, including a new dollar. Meanwhile, there will come a period of international monetary turbulence during which only gold or strongly gold-backed currencies will be trusted. During that period of time, assets measured in dollars will shrivel, as they are already doing now, at a less frantic pace. Those who have cornered the world's gold supply will be in a perfect position to vastly expand their own holdings and power. And so, contrary to the official books of the U.S. Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve System, America's monetary gold hoard has been largely spirited away. It began in 1961 under the London Gold Pool Agreement. For 7 years, enormous loads of American monetary gold were hemorrhaged out of Fort Knox and other depositories and sent overseas. In addition, there have been secret shipments of gold which are not reflected in official records at all. Through their control and manipulation of money, specifically the United States dollar, the money changers are stealing vast amounts of what countless millions have worked hard to produce. And just as they did in 1929 and afterward, they are again positioning themselves to set off economic disaster worldwide. Military, the secret plans and weapons for Armageddon. To most people, war is a supreme evil among human events, to be avoided if at all possible. And yet, we go right on having wars. To those who rule nations, war is a tool of power which is used deliberately. War can be used for external reasons, such as to increase the geographical extent of a nation's power. More importantly, war provides the perfect excuse for a government to impose increased controls on its own people. By citing national security, the government can persuade the people that even highly dictatorial controls are for their own good. These principles are among those laid out centuries ago by Machiavelli, who recommended to all rulers that they use wars regularly as a tool of power. But early in the 20th century, the Carnegie, Rockefeller and allied interests of the day dreamed of a world in which their power would be absolute and permanently assured. It would be a world at peace, the peace of a world inescapably within their grip. They formed a commitment to establish an eventual one world government. A leading institution which was created to coordinate this one world commitment was a tax-exempt foundation, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. In order to bring about the envisioned peace of a one-world government, it was clear that vast changes would have to be wrought in the lives of Americans, as well as of the other peoples of the world. Several years before World War I, the trustees spent an entire year debating the question, is there any means known to man that is more effective than war in changing the life of an entire nation? They concluded that the answer was no. And so, to start bringing about the changes needed under the long-range commitment for a one-world government, somehow America had to be gotten into war. The trustees debated how this could be done and concluded that it would be necessary to control the foreign policy machinery of the United States. That implied, in turn, that control had to be established over the State Department. Within a few years, the fruits of these deliberations began to be seen in U.S. actions. President Woodrow Wilson won re-election in 1916 on the theme, "He kept us out of war," and then promptly took the United States into World War I. On at least one occasion, the trustees of the Carnegie Endowment sent a telegram to Wilson urging him not to let American involvement in the war end too soon. The changes in American life which they desired were beginning to take place. World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War all were orchestrated in ways designed to serve the purposes of the long-range one-world commitment. But during the decades beginning with World War II, a factor unforeseen by the initiators of the one-world commitment grew steadily in importance. This factor was the ever-accelerating advancement of weapons technology. Starting with the atomic bomb, weaponry has advanced in ways not dreamed of in the early years of the 20th century. And these new technological capabilities have played a role in the progressive collapse of the one-world commitment as originally envisioned. In 1960, American scientists invented the laser, a device which produces an intense, narrow beam of light. Early lasers were crude and not very powerful, yet it was clear from theoretical studies that someday laser beam weapons would be possible. Other types of beam weapons were also foreseen which were potentially even more devastating than lasers. Suddenly there was a fatal flaw in the One World Commitment. The flaw was that it envisioned only one world, the Earth, as the entire arena of human activity. That was beginning to change, because mankind was beginning the conquest of space. In 1957, 3 years before the invention of the laser, the world's first man-made Earth satellite had been orbited by the Soviet Union, Sputnik I. The honor of being the first nation in history to do this had been handed to the Soviet Union, even though the United States had been technically capable of doing it first. The Soviet space program was far ahead of that of the United States when, in 1960, the invention of the laser suddenly added an urgent new dimension to the space race. The beam from a laser or other beam weapon can travel through space at the speed of light to strike a target a million miles away within a matter of seconds. Suddenly the moon had become a prize piece of military real estate. Whoever controlled the moon could someday use it as a base for beam weapons to control the Earth. In 1961, the four Rockefeller brothers inaugurated an elaborate, two-pronged program for world domination, with seizure of the moon as its centerpiece. On one hand, the United States would embark on a program of supposed disarmament, whittling back the power of America's visible military forces. But on the other hand, there would be increased emphasis upon development of advanced new secret weapons, unknown to the public and largely unknown even to Congress. And under the guise of a great adventure, the moon would be seized for unadmitted military purposes by way of the Apollo project. The four Rockefeller brothers had in mind an eventual double cross of their secret ally, the Soviet Union, in the programmed nuclear war to come. By seizing control of the moon and installing devastating beam weapons there, they expected to emerge as the final, absolute rulers of the entire world. In May 1961, President John F. Kennedy announced that the United States would land a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth before the end of the decade. Thus began a crash program 10 times bigger than the Manhattan Project to develop the atomic bomb during World War II. It was too big to hide, so instead its military nature was disguised by a constant glare of publicity to portray it all as a lark to pick up some moon rocks. And it succeeded. When Neil Armstrong planted man's first footprints on the moon in July 1969, it was a sensational event the world over. Little more than 3 years later, however, it was becoming routine enough in the public eye for America's manned moon program to be removed from public view. The final publicly admitted moon flight was Apollo 17 in December 1972. Thereafter, as the American public became increasingly absorbed in the Watergate scandal and other matters, the U.S. moon program continued secretly from a new base, the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. Different launch techniques were used there, involving the Skylab space station as a way station to the moon. While all of this was going on, unexpected developments were brewing in the Soviet Union. A progressive overthrow of the Bolsheviks was steadily accelerating. By the mid-1960s, the emerging new Kremlin rulers had learned about the planned Rockefeller double cross in a programmed nuclear war to come. They redoubled their efforts to complete their overthrow of the Bolsheviks. They also began preparing to beat the Rockefeller brothers to the punch with their own double cross. By the mid-1970s, present-day trustees of the major Rockefeller tax-exempt foundations were growing increasingly worried. Signs were multiplying that the One World commitment formed two generations earlier had jumped the tracks. They were right. In the summer of 1976, Dr. Beter reported on a major crisis which, to this day, has never been made public officially. This was the underwater missile crisis, in which the Soviet Navy was planting small underwater launch, short-range missiles with nuclear warheads. Inside American territorial waters, these were planted close to their targets, able to be fired at a moment's notice by satellite command. If fired, they would destroy coastal target areas with essentially zero warning time, the perfect, first strike. They were planted by means of small sonar-absorbing, super-quiet mini-submarines, designed to move in and out of American territorial waters without being detected by coastal sonar defense nets. The limited exposure of this crisis by way of the Dr. Beter audio letter reports enabled the late General George S. Brown, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to take action. Over protests by then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, General Brown persuaded then President Gerald Ford to give him the go-ahead to order the U.S. Navy to remove the missiles. In September 1976, Dr. Beter and an associate met with General Brown in his Pentagon office to discuss the crisis. In that meeting, Dr. Beter provided General Brown with the locations of a second round of Soviet underwater missiles. This was information General Brown did not have, thanks to an intelligence gap created by Kissinger in context with the former Rockefeller-Soviet alliance. Exposure of the Soviet missile planting program took away the crucial element of surprise and helped to avert war at that time. Even so, General Brown was soon neutralized as part of a hopeless Rockefeller attempt to restore the former Rockefeller-Soviet alliance, and many Soviet missiles were never removed from American waters. As the immediate crisis over the Soviet underwater missiles died down, Dr. Beter learned that other missiles also were planted under the sea. These had been planted earlier and were not Soviet, but American. In violation of international treaties, the United States had planted mammoth multi-warhead missiles on the ocean floor in the Atlantic and Pacific, targeted on the Soviet Union. The new Kremlin rulers bided their time, allowing the four Rockefeller brothers to convince themselves that they were succeeding in patching up the former alliance. But they were routing the Bolsheviks out of the Kremlin and out of many other high-level positions of power in Russia. At the same time, they were finalizing preparations for a surprise many times more decisive than that of the underwater missile crisis. As the autumn of 1977 approached, American beam weapons were nearing operational status at a secret military base nestled in Copernicus Crater on the Moon. But on the night of the Harvest Moon, September 27, 1977, the base was attacked and put out of action by the Soviet Union. For 10 years the Russians had been involved in a crash program to develop a family of particle beam weapons, which fire subatomic particles at a target at virtually the speed of light. A neutron beam weapon, fired from an orbiting, manned satellite, killed all the astronauts at the American moon base. The Russian satellite was partially disabled during the encounter. This was the nuclear-powered satellite, Cosmos 954. Which 4 months later created a worldwide sensation by coming to Earth in northern Canada. It was not a crash, but an emergency landing. The silencing of the secret U.S. moon base was the beginning of a lightning military takeover of space by the Soviet Union. During the final months of 1977, the Soviet Union deployed a space triad of manned strategic weapons, to which the United States has no counterpart. First came the Cosmos Interceptor. Killer satellites, which use particle beam weapons to blast other satellites out of existence. These started hunting down and destroying American spy and early warning satellites, one by one. Within about 6 months, by TBE spring of 1978, they completed the job. Meanwhile, Russia's new rulers were demanding that the United States begin laying down its arms by way of SALT II or risk unspecified dire consequences. These circumstances led to a desperate intelligence mission in April 1978, in which a Korean airliner flew into the most sensitive military airspace in the Soviet Union. Russian jet fighters forced the airliner down, but only after special equipment mounted in the plane radioed vital data on the Soviet military alert status to CIA receivers. In addition to spy satellites, a Russian Cosmos interceptor also destroyed the Skylab space station in mid-October, 1977, in order to block any American attempt to return to the moon. Skylab died in a giant fireball seen over much of the United States on October 18, 1977. NASA waited a week or so for all the puzzled questions over the mystery giant fireball to die away and then began a lengthy cover-up project, saying Skylab was sinking unexpectedly from orbit. This hoax was followed from start to finish in the Dr. Beter audio letter report series. The second leg of the Russian space triad was deployed and initially tested during October and November of 1977. It is a network of high-power particle beam weapons on the Moon, aimed at Earth. The first test of these in November 1977 was carried out under cover of a cyclone in the Bay of Bengal. The beam weapons produced a gigantic double flash. Due apparently to an aiming error in this first test shot, they also created a huge tidal wave which came racing out of the cyclone without warning to inundate large areas of the southeastern Indian coastline. Since that time, the lunar beam weapons have been fired only at target areas well out to sea, for weather modification purposes. Dr. Beter first reported on the characteristic brilliant double flash produced by the Russian lunar beam weapons in late 1977. Nearly 2 years later, an aging American Vela satellite happened to detect one of these double flash episodes in the South Atlantic. This led to dramatic rumors for a while that Israel had tested an atomic bomb in that area with the help of South Africa, since nuclear weapons produce a somewhat similar double flash. But nuclear weapons also produce several additional kinds of radiation along with the double flash, none of which were present in the South Atlantic episode. What the satellite accidentally detected was a test of a new technique for generating artificial storms, which Dr. Beter described in detail in February 1980. Since then, such artificial storms have been used repeatedly as a weapon of weather warfare. The third leg of the Russian space triad is a fleet of electrogravitic hovering platforms called Cosmospheres. These could have been developed by the United States, and in the early 1960s the late General Thomas Power, then commander of the Strategic Air Command, and others urged that this be done. But instead, all of America's secret space eggs were put into the basket of the Project Apollo moon program. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union went ahead with development of these platforms, and in December 1977 their operational deployment began. For several months they announced their presence in hair-raising fashion along the U.S. East Coast and elsewhere by creating mysterious giant air booms. They did this by firing their powerful charged particle beam weapons into the atmosphere in a defocused mode, in effect causing the air itself to explode. The air booms were an attempt at intimidation of the U.S. government, but did not accomplish much in that regard. After a few months, the air booms were halted. Today, Russian Cosmospheres routinely patrol high above all kinds of American strategic targets. They stand guard especially over American ICBM bases, ready to use their beam weapons to blast the missiles at the moment of launch in the event of war. The strategic weapons programs of the United States today are designed, first and foremost, to try to counter the secret space triad weapons of the Soviet Union. These weapons have yet to be made public by Russia's new rulers, who are well aware that it would precipitate a propaganda disaster for them if they did so. Likewise, America's rulers dare not publicly admit the existence of these weapons, which Russia has but America does not. They are afraid that the American public would react with everything from panic, to anger over America's space gap, to rage at having been lied to up to now. Congress too, having been largely manipulated and kept uninformed, could become unruly in the extreme. And so, while crash secret weapons programs have been underway in the United States since early 1978, they are kept hidden or their true nature is disguised. A wide range of weapons are involved, from high-power laser weapons with new infrared targeting, to retrofitting of Titan II ICBMs for fractional orbital bombardment with super-yield, doomsday, cobalt bomb warheads. It is not practical to review all of these developments reported by Dr. Beter in this bird's eye view section. Instead, the basic situation can be illustrated by considering just two weapons programs, the MX missile and the stealth aircraft program. The official justifications for these programs are always couched in terms of Russian weapons, which everyone knows about, primarily Russia's large missiles. These explanations never quite add up, because they are not the truth. As a result, controversy and questions keep swirling around these programs. As old rationales fray and fall apart, new ones are devised which also don't quite add up. Only when the truth about Russia's space triad is known do the American weapons programs make sense. Not pleasant sense, but sense. In June 1980, Dr. Beter described in detail what the MX program is all about. The big MX missile itself is actually of little importance, but the MX program is being used as an umbrella under which another, completely secret, missile system is being financed and deployed. Dr. Beter reported that the controversy then raging over proposals for a racetrack mobile basing system for the MX was only a lightning rod to draw attention away from deployment of America's real mobile missile. This is a much smaller missile, called the Minuteman TX. It was developed virtually from off-the-shelf hardware, and is deployed on America's railroads aboard special rail cars. Dr. Beter described these unique rail cars, and later several listeners spotted them and took photographs, which were published in a special bulletin for audio letter listeners. In October 1981, President Reagan shocked a lot of people by announcing that the MX missile would not be made mobile after all. The ridiculous racetrack scheme had served its purpose, which was deception, and was dropped. The controversy has continued, but the MX program has remained alive through it all. Early in 1983, after the termination of the audio letter report series, The concept of a smaller mobile missile was the key new ingredient in the public recommendations of the Scowcroft Commission on Strategic Nuclear Forces. Supposedly, such a small mobile missile, nicknamed Midgetman, could not be deployed until the early 1990s. But in actuality, that type of missile is deployed already. The Minuteman TX. Its biggest advantage has nothing to do with the alleged first strike threat of Russian ICBMs. Instead, the deployment of large numbers of small Minuteman TX missiles is intended to make it impossible for Russia's Cosmosphere fleet to keep tabs on them all. And as Dr. Beter detailed over the course of several audio letter reports, the mobile fleet of Minuteman TX missiles are not designed merely to survive a Soviet nuclear first strike. Instead, the Pentagon Bolsheviks intend to use them as the key to an eventual U.S. first strike against Russia. The other example to consider is the Stealth program. This is a multifaceted program, which actually involves not only aircraft but also a highly secret category of naval warships with their own special bases. Shortly after Dr. Beter reported on the existence of these special bases in the spring of 1982, they spawned naval warfare in the Southern Hemisphere. The visible portion of that conflict was the Falklands War. Restricting attention to the stealth aircraft program, the most radical and promising development is that of the Phantom Warplane. First revealed by Dr. Beter in the spring of 1982, the Phantom Warplane is as radical an advance in this computer age as the atomic bomb was in an age of adding machines and slide rules. By using powerful computer techniques, Einstein's semi-finished unified field theory has been used to design superconducting electromagnetic field equipment which can bend light waves. Built into an aircraft, this equipment creates a zone around the aircraft which light cannot penetrate. Instead, it flows around and onward, like water around a boulder in a stream. The result is that at a distance the airplane is invisible, not only to radar, but even to the eye. Public comments about the stealth program refer only to radar evasion, not to the far more startling capability of optical invisibility. Once again, this is done in order to limit discussion to a range of weaponry capabilities which will not raise too many public eyebrows. If the full capabilities of the Phantom Warplane were known, it would raise the question, why is something so radical needed? The answer lies with Russia's still secret beam weapons. The most important fact about the invisibility field of a Phantom Warplane is not the invisibility itself, but the protection which the same field provides against all types of beam weapons. The Bolsheviks who now control the United States Pentagon want to use all these weapons to crush the Soviet Union from which they have been overthrown and expelled. They have devised elaborate plans, detailed in the Dr. Beter audio letter reports, to set off a nuclear first strike by the United States against Russia. Nuclear false alarms, so-called, have been staged in order to test their ability to trigger what will look afterward like accidental nuclear war. American nuclear forces will be led to believe that they are retaliating, instead of striking first. The United States remains locked out of any large-scale, sustained military presence in space. Even so, a few key reconnaissance and other military tasks must be carried out in space in order to prepare for war. For that purpose, the space shuttle is being used in ways hidden from public view. The NASA space shuttle program is nominally civilian, but after the first space shuttle launch, the civilian director of the program was eased out. Today the shuttle director is Air Force General James Abramson. It is often said that the world today lives under the threat of a battle of Armageddon which, for the first time in history, could conceivably live up its apocalyptic description in the Bible. What is less well known is that certain satanic forces are actively planning for such a conflict and trying to bring it about. And they are harnessing the ingenuity of man to create Armageddon-style weapons about which the public is never informed. Summary: in surveying the 80 cassette tapes of the audio letter report series, a single gigantic picture emerges. The most striking thing about this picture is that countless seemingly unrelated, chaotic appearing news events turn out not to be chaotic after all. Instead, they are all tied together by a limited number of forces at work behind the scenes. Once one knows these forces, one becomes far better able to sort out the true meaning of events. Three major power groups are struggling today for worldwide influence and power. Like icebergs, they are partially visible but mostly hidden. These groups are the Rockefeller cartel of big oil, big banking and big business, the Bolshevik Zionist Axis, and the new Kremlin rulers of Russia. The relationships among these groups have shifted radically over the past decade or so. The Bolsheviks used to control the Soviet Union, and while they did, there was a secret alliance between them and the Rockefeller cartel. But they have been overthrown and expelled from top levels of power in Russia by the new Kremlin rulers, who are anti-Bolshevik and are, in fact, a secret sect of native Russian Christians. During 1976 and 1977, Russia's new rulers unilaterally terminated the longtime Rockefeller-Soviet alliance, together with its plans for programmed nuclear war on the way to a one-world government. The four Rockefeller brothers, then in control of the Rockefeller cartel, welcomed the expelled Bolsheviks from Russia into positions of power here in the United States. That was a fatal mistake, which led to the overthrow of the four Rockefeller brothers at Bolshevik hands from mid-1978 to early 1979. Since that time, there has been a steadily intensifying power struggle between the Bolsheviks here and the regrouped Rockefeller cartel for control over the U.S. government. Generally speaking, the Bolsheviks have been getting their way in military affairs, while the Rockefeller cartel has greater power in the economic realm. Since early 1982, there has been a limited quid pro quo between the Rockefeller cartel and the new Kremlin against their common bitter enemy, the Bolsheviks. Meanwhile, the strong links between the American Bolsheviks and the Zionist rulers of Israel have been forged into a secret joint military junta, the Bolshevik Zionist Axis, bent on war. Politics, economics, and international relations, including war, are constantly used by these world power factions as they struggle with one another. Economic manipulations, covert intelligence maneuvers, and a proliferating array of secret weapons are features of this struggle. But as made clear in many of Dr. Bitter's tapes, the basic struggle is a spiritual one. Dr. Bitter terminated his audio letter report series in November 1982 due to declining health. Events which have taken place since then are beyond the scope of this reference digest. Even so, peppered throughout the tapes are many discussions of plans and events still in gestation, and knowing those plans can help provide many clues to the meaning of events still to come. Beyond that, the past is always prologue to the future. By studying the many events which ran their course during the 7-odd years of the Dr. Bitter audio letter series, one can learn a great deal about the underlying forces still at work in our world.